This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you very much, Rob. I'd like to take a minute and thank Rob and Mike for doing what they do every year. I think that's great. When Rob contacted me this year and asked me if I'd do something, there was, besides the first words out of my mouth, which were no, there's something that happened this year that I didn't want to let pass, and I agreed to do this again. And I think it's been like 4 years, 5 years since we did this. And it's one of those sort of events that if you're a collector, it isn't as big a deal as it is for the people in the industry. And this to me, and to them in particular, is a big deal. This is the 20th anniversary of us breaking the record for the best-selling pinball of all time, and the game is still on Playmeter's poll for the best-earning pinball machines of operators in the country. To put that in perspective to people who aren't in this business, there is only one other game. Here, hang on. I brought along a prop, but it's a real prop. See, this is Playmeter. This is an industry magazine for those of you that aren't that haven't been in the business or aren't in the business. By the way, how many people here? Is this your first expo? Is there anybody here this year? Yay! Look at that! Wow. Okay. Since I haven't done this for a while, if you haven't seen me do this, my being centered part of the world was in what these games do for people who need them to make money, which is what they were invented for. They were invented to make money for somebody. And so that's the way I continue to look at things, even though the pinball world has moved on to predominantly be building toys for people's basements, as opposed to building games that make money. But Playmeter still has a poll every month of the top earning games, and let me put this here for a second so I can open up to the page, because here we go. This is Playmeter from this July, and it says here that the Addams Family is the second earning pinball that month, just ahead of AC/DC. That made me giggle a little. It also says that Pat Lawler hasn't built a game for 4 years, and four of his games are on the poll, so that makes me feel good too. But besides making myself feel good, they award points in here for, they're called longevity points, and it's how long you've been on their poll and how much it's done for you. And as of a year ago, the only game that had ever beaten us was Whack-A-Mole. That gives you an example of what we've done. So this is the 20th anniversary of us doing that, of setting that record. And for the record was 20,232. That was the record number. And we ended up building 21,238 games. And in a minute, we're going to show you a few pictures of what the factory looked like when we were building all those games, in excess of 220 a day, which would be, I don't know, like a month and a half of Stern's production right now or something. I don't know. Anyway. So what I want to do now is I want to introduce you to these guys. And I want them to real briefly tell you who they are and what they did on the game. And if you've got an extra second, you guys tell them what you do now. Or if you're like John, and we're all jealous of John, he's retired. And then we'll go from there. So John, why don't you grab a mic and tell people.
My name is John Yalsey, and back in 92, I was a freelance illustrator and was asked by Pat to do the artwork for Adam's Family. I was super excited about it, and I was working on another game at the time, but I had no idea what was going to happen. But thank goodness that I was asked to work on this game. Right now I'm working for IGT. I still do games. I do slots. I did the artwork, most of the artwork for AC/DC as well, a number of other games for Stern. I'm John Crutch.
I'm John Crutch. I did the mechanical engineer. I did all the mechanical stuff on all of Pat's games, and eventually wound up being the manager of the mechanical engineering department until the end.
Larry DeMar, I'm so glad to be with these guys. When we come back to these shows, it really helps me relive some of the greatest moments of my career. We had such an amazing group of talented guys doing things, and I work with some really great people now, but it's never been like it was at Williams. Can I rattle on a little bit? Pat's shaking his head, yes.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting that I never thought that I would encapsulate our quest and our career by trying to reach the pinnacle of whack-a-mole. So that was an interesting point. Right now, I actually have two ventures. The one that's maybe most interesting to this crowd is along with Joe Kamenko from Data East Sega Pinball. We started a company where we're making games for Facebook. The company is called Spooky Cool Labs, and we have a new Wizard of Oz game that is going to be opened up on Facebook. We've been working on it about 2 years, and it's opening up in about 8 days. It's in closed beta right now, and Chris, to my left, is doing all the audio on that, and it's so great to be back with Chris. And before I pass up the mic, there are, as you all know, I was very close with Steve Kordek over the years, and particularly after we all left Williams. And his family, his three of his four children are going to be here tonight or tomorrow night for a tribute that's following the banquet or during the banquet. And Steve's daughter is trying to get a pinball machine from Chicago to her home, which is outside of L.A. And so if there's anybody that is or knows somebody that could help us out that's taking a truck from here to there full of pinball machines after the show, let me know after this talk, and I'd love to help them out. And I'm going to pass it over to Chris.
I'm Chris Graner. And I did sound for Adam's Family, Sound of Music. One of probably maybe two or three absolute, you know, high peak, pinnacle highlights of my career. I'm tremendously lucky in that I can say that there's more than one. This absolutely was one of them. This is probably as all-star a team as I've ever worked with. The overall quality and care and innovation and dedication that this team exhibited at the time that we put this game together certainly never been equaled on my, you know, in anything that I've been involved with since. Just a tremendously talented and dedicated. They talk about Michael Jordan being a supremely talented overachiever. Talent is great, and talent gets you in the door. And then you have to show up for work every day and every night until it's done. You don't get to go home at 5. You don't get to go home until it's done. and we didn't go home until it was done. And, you know, this was the result. It wasn't all us. It was, you know, there's a lot of luck involved and a lot of, ways the winds blow and stuff like that. But you, in a lot of ways, you make your own luck, and we made some pretty great luck, you know, in this regard. It's really an honor to be here, and it's great to see, you know, a pretty full house to acknowledge. Right now, I live in Munchkin Land, and I'm busily trying to figure out why the confetti in the flower beds doesn't go pop when I say go pop. But, I'm just all Wizard of Oz all the time these days. And now to Roger Sharp.
I'm Roger Sharp. I was the one that actually talked Pat into doing Adam's Family. It was a tough sell, but I think the result, as we all know, was well worth the effort. I'll do a brief aside, because I just realized and remembered Pat had a point to prove internally. At the time, for those who remember, at least historically, we had acquired the amusement game division from Bally Midway back in '88, and brought on board some of their designers, and some of them thought that by having a Bally-branded game versus a Williams game, that somehow the marketplace wasn't going to be as accepting, production runs weren't going to be as big. And Pat stood up, because Pat had been doing Williams-branded pinball machines, and it was like, okay, I'll show you what we can do with a Bally brand. And at that point in time, everything under the hood was basically the same. So forgetting about what we had done with Atlantis and some of the other games from back then, Truck Stop. So it was all basically one and the same, but Pat stepped up, and I think the result, as they say, is ongoing and enduring history. Anyway, currently licensing brand manager at WMS Gaming. So it's still Williams, but it's different now. Now it's slot machines, not pinball machines and video games. And I also have my own company and do consulting, and sometimes people want to get licenses or other things, and I do that too. So, my story.
I have something for you guys. You know, you wait 20 years, and all you get is this stupid T-shirt. And you were going for that line, weren't you, Chris?
That was exactly where I was.
And there are only, we only, I, if you don't know what I do, my day job now is working with, that's my wife right there taking pictures. That's Pat. Say hi to Mrs. Pat. Hi, Mrs. Pat.
That's the boss. She's the boss there.
And Mrs. Pat, 15 years ago, started a company called Hyperstitch, which is custom embroidery and screen printing. And now that's sort of what my day job is. I do screen printing. I'm the head of screen printing at Hyperstitch. And so in order to commemorate this, I said I didn't get a stupid T-shirt 20 years ago. So I made my own. But more importantly, I made exactly enough for one of them. And that's all there are. There'll never be any more. And afterwards, here.
eBay.
Why don't you hold it up? They're pretty fun. It says 20th anniversary, something special, the best-selling, longest-lived, best-earning pinball of all time. Yay. All right, let's do some pictures. We'll run through pictures. A lot of these pictures are, 20 years old. They're pretty funny. And then we're going to do questions. Hopefully we'll have a few minutes left. We'll do questions from you guys. We'll talk about Adams and why there's a bunch of old guys up here who are so proud. Like that. So the first slide, this was actually the cover of either Playmeter or Replay. Which one do we know? Replay, this was Replay. You guys need to jump in when you want to do something. Yeah, whatever. This was taken with the day that we set the record. That was the record-setting game that's sitting in amongst everybody there. That singular game, that was the end of the first run, which meant all the games were blue, except for that game and a couple of odd games that were on the line. They made a couple of cabinets to make sure we didn't screw up and not have a cabinet that day. But that's actually a gold front, gold rail game, but not a gold game, not a game of the 1,000. And all of those people that are standing there smiling, including Larry, Steve Kordek is there on the left. Chairman of the board, Neil Nicastro, is over on the right there. Larry will point him out. Joe is there in the front. He, at the time, was head of engineering. And that's engineering, and the people in the factory, the plain old people who assembled the game, are back there in the factory.
And when I introduced myself, I didn't actually say what I did. I worked on the software for this game with working with Pat. And then Mike Boone, who is right here, worked on the software with me. Fabulous programmer.
That's what Mike Boone's kid looks like now.
And he's celebrating his 25th wedding anniversary today, so he is most likely not going to be here, but we might find him here with some cake or something. I don't know.
Another current colleague, Scott Slomiani, is off there in the corner that Larry's.
Right, and Scott worked on the game also. Scott was, if you look at the credits at the bottom of the game, Dots by Scott, that's Scott. And Scott is also responsible for all the cows in the games, if you know about the cows in all our games.
And if you're playing Where's Waldo, and I don't know if you can see it very clearly, but we found Waldo hiding up here in the very back of
there you go.
Of the picture, that's Roger.
Okay. Next picture.
Next picture.
There, Larry found this
Adams
picture.
Family. Pinball. This was, you know, Pat was mentioning that when we did the gold game as the last game of the run, there were some extra back boxes, extra cabinets brought in. And there are several games that look like this, blue top, gold bottom, gold top, blue bottom, because that's how they ended up getting put together by our factory, who was really great most of the time.
And well, the thing is, at the end, see, nobody knew we were going to make gold games, right? Nobody knew we were going to make 1,000 more games. As far as the factory was concerned, they were done. That was it. They had broken the record. They were done that day. They weren't going to build any more Adams families. And so they had these cabinets sitting there, and they, you know, they knew how management wanted them to behave, which was build as many games as you can and get them out and make some money. And so they did. And that's an example of what happens when, you know, you build games. The question is, did we know at that point that we'd make 1,000? The answer is no. That day when we finished, we were done. And it wasn't until a few months later that the sales department was getting beat up every day wanting to know how come I couldn't have more Adams families. And remember, these aren't collectors. These are operators. These are people who are making some. In a little bit here, we're going to show you an earnings report. But that we had no idea. We had no idea.
A bunch of these pictures are just close-ups of the detail in the gold game that was taken for some reason. We've been searching our archives for what we could bring.
Ah, there you go. This is Adams Family cereal. You mean you never got any?
The edition that dispensed cereal when you hit a high score, right. That only went to South America. Did anybody see it?
Right. This was one of Paramount's marketing coups. And as Roger, as part of the deal, did we give away a game to the cereal people or no? That wasn't that. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we gave away like 5 games along the way.
It's not possible that I'm the only person here who when first saw this thing, read free doorknob hanger. Free doorknob hanger.
Free doorknob hanger.
Free doorknob.
It on the back it had things hand, and it like was great, and you'd cut it out and put it on your doorknob. It was pretty cool. This is. I'm sorry for the quality. I took this with my camera of my drawing board when I was working on Adams. That is actually the drawing of the game. That is actually we weren't using CAD yet, and so that's actually a full size mechanical drawing of the game. that I did in order to get it in production.
This is a wonderful piece of archaeology because this is how games used to be made. There was this piece of, it was vellum, and they would punch holes and draw and erase and draw and erase and draw and erase. And compared to what is being done, you know, using AutoCAD now, it is the Stone Age, but it is what we did. And it was done in full scale. So you were working with exactly what you played and experienced in front of you one-to-one, which is probably a big advantage that's, I think, lost on AutoCAD.
Absolutely. So we all had, all the game designers had drawing boards that were that size, right? You had this big drawing board that you sat at, and you actually sat there and drew the game. And what Larry just said is absolutely true, that when we went to CAD, if you're perceptive, go look at the games. If you can see where Williams sort of went pre-CAD and then after CAD, and you're going to see where the game designers tried to stuff a whole lot more stuff in there when they got to CAD, because in CAD it all looks good. It's all this big. And so you're going, oh, yeah, put that there, put that there, put that there, put that there. And all of a sudden, you go to build the real thing, and you realize, well, the shot's this big. That's not going to work. But when you were looking at it full size, hey, it was a real game.
And I've zoomed in. I don't know if you can really appreciate on the blow-up, but this is really all an eraser smudge. I mean, it's one giant eraser smudge with heavy lines over what it is. You can see around the bookcase it's a little less smudge because that kind of went in and didn't change much. But everything around it probably changed 30 times.
Actually, the thing that changed the most, if you look at in the upper right corner of that picture, which is where the bookcase is, the bookcase I actually hand drew in a piece of, I wore out the drawing, and I had a hand-drawn piece of vellum that I would tape down over the area that I wore out erasing, putting in. And there's one more point we'll make about this, and then we'll move on, which is Steve Ritchie liked to say this, and I learned from him. The difference between great game designers and mediocre game designers are the great game designers were the guys that were willing to get out their eraser and tear huge chunks out of that thing. Okay, you were standing there and you went, that doesn't work. Well, the sort of average game designers went, that's too much work. I'm not going to erase all that. I'm done. And the good game designers went, you know, they had a pile of eraser shavings on the floor this deep underneath what they were doing. Okay, and it was really funny. You'd go to a meeting somewhere and somebody'd go, oh, no, he's erased that part again, hasn't he? And but that's how games were done. That's how games were done.
Now there's no more eraser companies.
Right.
Sell that eraser stack.
Right.
No more vellum.
Ah, this is the invitation to the premiere of the movie that we took the prototype to, and so that's the invitation with Angelica Houston, Raul Julia.
My favorite is at the lower right. It says dress. That's not black tie. It's just dress was black.
Right.
I remember shopping around L.A. for a black shirt when we were there that afternoon.
Here's a picture of the Williams factory during production of the game. That is just the burn-in pack area and final test. And actually, there's a row you can't see behind it. There would have been another row of that. What's interesting to me is, I want to do this on purpose. You're doing what I'm doing. What's the game in the back corner?
Anybody?
I don't know. I didn't know. I don't know. Can you kind of move over to that anyway?
I can't. I don't recognize it. And
is it Hurricane? No. There you go.
Yep.
That's Hurricane. Okay, they're all going, yeah, and they know. So,
you know, in past years, Pat would have handed out a prize or one of limited T-shirts.
Yeah.
The economy has hit the Pat Lawler show.
No, hell no. We know what that stuff's worth now. But listen, if you hadn't been here and hadn't seen the Pat Lawler Show, we used to give away. We'd all come in carrying big boxes of stuff. We emptied out our offices of all this stuff that was, you know, cast-offs and stuff. And I'd stand up here and we'd give it away. We'd ask questions. We'd give the audience stuff. And then we learned about eBay. And so, you know, we literally over the years probably gave away, you know, $10,000 worth of stuff. Tens of thousands of dollars worth of stuff.
The one that stands out in my mind wasn't the Pat Lawler Show. We were at one of the trade shows, and Attack from Mars was the game at the show, and Brian Eddy got a box that probably had 500 Martians in it, and he was throwing them in handfuls to the crowd, literally, when the game was new. And for those of you that have, you know, tried to get Martians for your game, that one always sticks with me.
Here's a picture of a very small part of the assembly line, because the assembly line wound through the factory. I used to go down after everybody left for the day, and I'd take pictures, and John adopted a name for me. He'd say, "Pat's trolling for trouble." And what I'd do is I'd walk the entire assembly line after everybody went home, and all I'd do is I'd walk along, and I'd be glancing at the assembly line, and inevitably I'd get over to somewhere and I'd go, "No!" And figure out how many games we had to back up because they had been screwing parts down in the wrong place or because they had done something crazy. And then I'd go find the factory manager, and he'd run back, and then the next morning they'd do what they did. And, you know, when you're building that many games a day, just stop and, for people who aren't in the business, stop and think about that. 230 games a day. 230 cabinets a day, every day. 230 times 60 switches a day. And so Cherry, who made our switches, had an assembly line which was just for us. It was just for Williams. And it was amazing. What? Chris is beside himself. Okay. I love this picture. That's the sub-assembly station for Things Hand. And so they'd get done with them, and they just hang the hands on the wall. And the funny thing about Thing was that the actual hand, they had to dole out exactly as many hands as they were going to use that day on the assembly line, because after the first week, they started finding hands coming out of people's cars, coming out of people. They were all disappearing. Everybody had a hand. So they would put out exactly as many hands as they were going to build that day.
Gave new meaning to the concept of having a hand in the game.
That's right, exactly. Here's a cabinet subassembly, and that's putting together the cabinets that eventually ended up being the game. This is test. This is playfield test, and so if you look down the line, every one of those playfields is in a fixture backed by an electronic fixture that's being tested, and then on the other side of them, which would be on the right there a little bit. Down. There's exactly another set of fixtures back to back. And so all of those were manned by a tester all day long, and his job was just to make sure that the switches and everything worked the way that it was made. This is the point where the playfield's complete and it's getting ready to be put into a cabinet, and then off on the right you can see the cabinets are being completed, and right sort of down here where you are is where you took the playfield and dumped it into the cabinet and did what you did.
What's interesting to me, and I guess there's not a lot of people still at WMS who go back as far as I do, but is looking at the factory pictures, because the entire building still exists, but it's now all been gutted out, and it's offices and cubes, and it's engineering and production and what have you, not physical production, but more engineering and test for slot machines. And I wind up telling people, well, this is where the assembly line used to be, and this is where we used to box them. So for me, it's a great trip down memory lane.
And if you go back to my distant past. There, here's where we used to wind transformers. Here's where we used to wind the coils. Here's where we made all the cables. Here's where we stamped out the switches. It evolved during our reign.
Here's where we plated things.
To light assembly. Yeah.
That's the amazing thing. Here's where we plated parts. Okay. You know, there's a reason why they've never sold the building.
Who can tell me what this is? Picture of what? Gold Playfield. That's right. The is that Dominic in back? Good answer. In addition to the gold trim and the gold legs and the gold paint, Pat and John pumped up the colors. So it is the yellow, the orange are much hotter on the gold version, and it's clear in this picture.
Right, which is another way you can tell people who've cheated and stuck the button in the trim on a game and tried to call it gold. That's Larry's game. That's number two. I guess you were taking pictures for things. This is great. This is a test report from, it says there, 8-26-91, okay, on location. And go, can you slide it a little bit to the left at all? Is that possible?
You've got the whole thing.
There you go. 11-27-91 is actually the date of Adams. And this was at Times Square, which was an arcade in Chicago. And I brought this along for two reasons: to show people that pinball machines used to make money. On Broadway. Right, Times Square. And so if you look, they used to compare their most recent smash hit, which was Terminator, and then they'd look to see how good your game was next to it in its first weeks that was somewhere. And I'm going to teach you a little bit about reading test reports. The first thing you're looking at is if you start on week two for both games, because usually the first week the game's only there a partial week and you don't know what it's going to make.
Is that the pinball or is that the video? It's August. It's got to be the video on test.
No, this was. If you they're comparing it old.
Two different dates.
That's not the video. That's T2 was built before Adams.
That's what
you
I'm
think
saying.
So? Okay, I believe that. In any case,
the video game was coming out in the summer.
The pinball would have been. Yeah, the pinball would have been. Would have been. Early.
So if you look, you've got your first week's earnings. Anything above at that in those days? Remember, these games were. Was Adams three for a dollar? Three for a dollar. So we were earning $355. But what they looked for. What you look for on a test report is, does the game earn its most the first 2 weeks it's there and then all of a sudden it starts to do this? Or does the game do this? Or in the case of a very few games, does it do that? Which is, it starts out and then it starts to do this. And I'm going to tell you a story I've told before. I'm going to tell it again. Larry and I used to call each other. We'd be out fixing our test games. We'd be out just making sure they were working and stuff. And he'd be in Chicago and I'd be out in the suburbs. He called me he called me one night and he said, Pat, I'm looking, you know, like during that $454 week. And he said, oh my God, we found the promised land. and it was true. It was true. There was a game that didn't earn what it earned its first 2 weeks. It started doing this. And, I mean, you know, think about those earnings in today's dollars. Think about those earnings in today's dollars. And if you could do that again, you'd actually be able to sell pinball machines to operators. Well, Adams only cost $2,500 back then, so $3,000. All right, we can move on. Gold, Whitewood. That is a picture of not the final Whitewood, but there's a couple of real interesting things about this Whitewood that I'll bet you Larry can pick out, or anybody up there can pick out. See if you can, which does not fit. What thing up there does not belong? Which of these things does not belong? I'm sorry. Nope. This was a pretty getting close to final whitewood. And you can tell because there aren't giant holes drilled in it with Bondo. Yeah, there you go. I knew he'd find it. And what's that out of? Yeah, except that's out of Funhouse. That's a Funhouse mirror. And so we were, if you'll notice, there are no indicator lights over like the bookcase and behind the shot to thing and stuff. And so what was going on here was the game team, Larry probably in particular, was struggling with the idea that we had these shots that weren't telling you what to do. And so we probably just grabbed the nearest piece we had laying around, which was the Funhouse mirror, wired it up real quick so we had a way of showing what we were doing, and then later on we added the other key lights that went on the top of the game to show you where to shoot and where to blink and all that other stuff.
I'm still trying to remember, we might have been using those for a thing with five lights, no?
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm trying to figure out, I don't remember those lights.
What the feature was,
yeah, or anything.
And I'm just trying to...
They weren't. They never ended up that way. This picture, by the way, the back of the picture was dated August 1991. So we weren't, obviously we weren't ready to go and take the game. We were months away. All right. This is another picture taken the day we set the record. This is the game team, some of the game team. And Neil Nicastro, Ken Fidesna. I wish Ken were here today. He usually tries to come to these and couldn't make it. And of course, there's Roger, and Scott, and Larry, and John, and Mike Boone, and the giant ribbon which I still have. Ah, this is funny. We went to the show. It would be 20 years ago, right about now. That's great. That is Neil Nicastro, the chairman of the board of WMS, kissing me. And if you'll see the look on John's face, he's horrified, of course. If you see the look on my face, I'm horrified. And, of course, I'll explain.
Larry's afraid he's next.
Right. We had just won the award for the best pinball machine of the year at one of the big trade shows. And Neil Nicastro, of course, didn't care about the award. He cared about how much money the game had just made the corporation. And so that's what that was. And I've kept that all these years. That's a really great picture.
In this picture next to Ken Fidesna is Joe Dillon. Joe was our director of sales. Fantastic guy. Really, part of the decline that occurred 94, 95, 96 as we moved forward and the industry declined. Joe got sick in that era and died. And I've always felt that he was kind of the glue to all of the customers, that they really trusted Joe, and he really believed in us, and it made a huge difference in the amount of product that could be sold really on trust, faith, and in continuing business. And when I look back on the eventual demise of our pinball operation, I really wonder what would have happened if Joe was still with us as we went through the different phases and brought out Pinball 2000. I think Pinball 2000, if Joe was there, would have been a stunning success.
Yes, absolutely.
He was a major, major supporter of pinball over the years. Was at Bally for a number of years and Williams. But Joe was great, very much beloved and respected in the industry. And I think to Larry's point, if Joe had kept his health and remained alive, I think that the outcome for Pinball 2000 would have been far different. And you would have seen finished Wizard Blocks. You would have seen the finished Playboy. And golly knows where we would be today.
Just as a sort of word of explanation, besides a testament to somebody, the business for many, many, many years was, you know, it's like a lot of businesses. It's a this is a misnomer, but it's an old boy network. It's people who trust each other. And pinball through the years has its ups and, you know, had its ups and downs. And so the distributors who sold the games basically trusted a small handful of people to make sure that, you know, they weren't jerked around too badly when there was a bad game. And conversely, they made sure that he took care of them with a good game. And they trusted Joe. And the same thing was true with our customer in Germany, with Hans. Everybody trusted him. He was a pinball guy. And when those guys got out of the business, there was a void. There were people there who, you know, all of a sudden there was somebody new that you had to believe was telling you this was going to be a good thing to make you money. And your first tendency was, don't believe them, in a lot of respects.
The thing I'll point out, and I know that Jack's sitting here, I mean, the success that Jack has already enjoyed without really having games yet, but pre-selling and everything else is, number one, his passion for pinball, and number two, the fact that people really believed in him, and, you know, you see Wizard of Oz now, so I think that it's to Pat's point, it's all relationships. It's, you know, trusting people, people who keep their word, people who have a passion for the business, and more importantly, who have passion for pinball, want to keep it alive, want to see it thrive. So hats off to what Jack's been able to do so far today.
I would actually kind of go, I would, if you would let me, yes. I would go one more observation sort of in parallel to what Pat was talking about and what Larry's talking about. Joe, relationships are great stuff. The other thing that this game had going for it that that, you know, you look through the list of the games that we made when things were at their peak. You know, you look at Terminator, you look at Indy, you look at Star Trek, you look at you know, the just a stunning array of games, Twilight Zone, games that we made, you know, during that time when we were at, you know, we were riding this incredible wave. The starting with Funhouse, in my sense, something was happening in the world, okay? Something was happening that... that brought people back to pinball, that brought large audiences of people back to pinball, and no game embodied that phenomenon and embodied that process more than this game, more than Addams Family. People played this game that didn't ordinarily play pinball. And that is the magic. That is the magic, is that broadening of the base of players. You know, we all love pinball. We eat, live, and breathe pinball, and that keeps us coming back here every year. And that keeps Gary in, you know, making whatever, you know, 5,000-6,000 games a year or whatever he makes. And you know, maybe Jack's going to add to that number, and, you know, we all pray for that. You know, what's going to bring the casual player back? What's going to make that happen? And that's, I think, yeah, that's the question Jack's asking. That was the question this game answered in spades. A game like this brings them back. There's a ton of innovation in this game. There's a ton of really cool stuff that we basically invented in this game that still is in most pinball games. Rule-wise, shot-wise, just the way that we think about games. And we have this just unbelievably A-plus, triple-A, you know, concept license, great movie, great, you know, just so many things came together at this point. And, you know, I don't know, it gives you, you know, it's something to think about. It's something to think about.
Yeah. I think what we're going to do now is we're going to let you guys ask questions, if you'll hang on a second. I just want to touch on something Chris said. For the guys who were in the business or who are still in some form of games, we, because it's what we do, we look at games differently than you do. I like to tell people we dissect fun. That's our job. We dissect fun. And so looking back on this particular product after 20 years, historically, this game was what set up a whole lot of product afterwards, and in some cases to the detriment of the industry. By that by that mechanic, that gameplay mechanic, not changing over 20 years. And I've said that before, and I make people angry. But play a ball, start a mode, finish the mode, finish all the modes, play a wizard mode, you know. Sound like any pinball machines you've played in the last 20 years? All of them. Except that before Adams, there were really only two or three games that even touched on the sort of, we've got this little game running inside of a game. And to be totally fair, the first game in my memory that I can touch on that wasn't just a timed mode, a timed thing, but a actual mode was John's game. The Rowdy Ramp Round, Cue Ball Wizard, and that was sort of the first inkling. Funhouse did. Get Yourself a Hot Dog, and then Adam's Family exploded it. That gameplay mechanic as a thing that you do in pinball machines. Now you just saw an insight into how we think. Okay, time for questions. Sir.
Hi, Matt. My name is Brian, and I just got back to pinball. My first game I bought in February was Whirlwind, so thank you so much for everything you do. I've heard you talk about how Adams was kind of a game changer as far as software architecture is concerned. Do you have any views or opinions on how this architecture should move in the future to do something different than we have seen in 20 years?
Take it.
It really comes down to when you do something different, you're taking a chance. I think that's what has driven the industry the way it's going. We experienced it firsthand, and it was painful. There was very little room for error in what we were doing. We had to have the games. We had to get them done, on a time frame. We had to get them out there, and they had to keep our production line running for some number of weeks or months. And as the industry was getting very soft, there was very little room for error. And eventually, it was our company structure and the business model didn't match anymore, which eventually caused the company to close. I think that the situation's worse than we experienced as far as room for error and to keep Stern going or for Jack to keep games going. And when we would do things to create something new, to innovate, like Safecrackers, a great example. Pinball. And I think Pat did Safecracker with that exact same mindset. We're doing game after game, and we're going to die if we keep doing Adam's Family for 20 years. And the answer to that is it's a lot of risk, and doing something that isn't just reworking what everybody's used to is a risk. The other thing that frustrated me no end is, I still believe this, I believe we went off on a path from game to game with the features and the modes and the wizard modes and the whatever it was, and we went down this path and we got off a real sustainable path, and we had all of the players, a lot of which are here and collect and are very passionate, okay, wanted this set of things in a game, but the guys on the trunk of the tree couldn't play these games anymore. And so we everybody tried, and they did a game where the tournament thing, where they were just... Didn't Dwight work on that over at... was it at Stern the first time? Thank you, Cherokees, yeah.
Right.
And it was, again, it was how do we get so that anybody can play pinball? And before I monopolize all the time, the other thing I just wanted to add was the biggest change in design that I think led us into being where we didn't belong was all the ramp shots returning the ball to a controlled flipper feet. Pinball, and go play a 60s game, the whole game will last a minute 30, okay, if you have a good one. It had a lot of randomness, and you would play and you would have a great game by doing some good things and having good luck. And I think systematically, both with ball savers and with ball deliveries, we took the randomness out a little at a time. And out on this branch of the tree, boy, we heard it from every side, everybody. You know, take the ball saver off. We didn't put a ball saver on Twilight Zone. Okay, it was, oh my God, there's no ball saver. And little by little, we just worked out here, took the randomness out, and I think that was a terrible hole to dig ourselves out of.
What actually, there's a historical thing I'm going to jump on real quick here, and then we're going to go to the next question, okay, because we're running out of time. Ball saver was put into a Steve Ritchie game because Steve Ritchie, late in the game, understood that he had created a play field that was so center drain heavy that he didn't know what to do. Okay? It was T2. Okay? You'd fire the ball onto the play field, the ball would fall between the flippers, and internally everyone was screaming at him, "This sucks." Okay? And so he said, "I have invented ball save." And it worked. Except that every game after that, the rest of the people internally at Williams went, "Game's got to have ball save. Where's your ball save, man?" And we were going, "Dude, the game's not going to make any money. You keep giving people back pinballs." That's how things happen that you don't want to, you know, where the industry to go. Next question. Sir, in the back.
Quick story that I need confirmation on, and you'll know who it is on the board that's going to convert this. So I'm retiring from pinball repair. I show up with Vixen Adams' family, and they go, "Here's the game." So I look at it, I turn it on, I turn on the shirt, it lights up, and there's wool all over this playing field. It looks like stuff had been moved, and it doesn't look like production. So I'm like, "That's not a big deal." I pulled out the back glass, it's all red boards, and a bunch of stuff doesn't. So I looked at the play field, I was like, "Oh my God, I just wanted to run." And there's part of a wiring harness that says strip, and there's several wires on it. You can't tell where they go anymore. I don't like to get beat. So I fixed the thing, I play tested it, and I assume the husband comes home. And he's like, "We've got it working. I can't believe you got it working. You're the third guy we called out here, and nobody can get this thing working. Scratch your head and just ran." And he was excited, and he goes, "My brother did all the sounds for this game." I never asked him.
Are you from Ann Arbor?
Pardon me?
Are you from Ann Arbor?
I live in Michigan.
Yeah, well, I know. But so it's my brother David.
I couldn't remember his name, but I remember how he paid me. I didn't know him.
Does he owe you money? He's going to really enjoy hearing this story. It's great. You know, it's you know, what did we get? Did we get the first 12 games or whatever? You know, it was, they were, you know, it's a wonder that they worked at all. You know, they're put together by hand, and God knows what quality control processes. You know, so those were the games that were available to the design teams to buy.
That meant that you had one of the prototypes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had one of the prototypes. So there's 30 prototypes that are made. Probably in the case of Adam's family, there were 20. 20 prototypes were made. It would have been one of the 20 prototypes that we put out on test or whatever. They come back off of test. We clean them up a little, and the game team got them. Okay, so that was literally one of the first 20 games. And the reason that it looked like parts had been screwed into different places was because parts had been screwed into different places. And probably by me. because I'd go in after hours, and when we were getting ready to go on test, I'd sit there and go, no, that shot doesn't work. That one doesn't work. And then I'd go update my drawing and whatever, and that's why they look that way.
And my brother has it because I moved from a place that had a really nice game room basement to a place that doesn't. Other than that, the house is really nice. I'm really happy I moved. My wife is really, really happy I moved. But I have one game left. And so all my games went out on loan. And David got the Adams. His twin brother, Rob, got the Fishtails. That game is currently... lives at, this is a wacky story that I'll take 10 seconds with. It's at Genuine Scooter, which is here in Chicago. You can, you know, feel the love. It's genuine. It's they make motor scooters. They make the Buddy. You've seen them all over the place. They're really cool. The owner of that place hires a guy named Luther Rochester, who's always here. He dressed as Rudy for his Halloween costume in 1990. He's a great guy, and he fixed that Fishtails up into, it plays like a Stradivarius. It's an amazing, amazing setup. And that game currently is at Genuine, but it's coming to Spooky Cool next week. So just to let you know.
Questions? Sir.
I like your phrase, dissection of fun, and people seem to spend a lot of time dissecting fun, but they all come to different conclusions about what they're seeing, about what the parts are. So has that dissection improved over time, or is it still just about trust and guessing and we're hoping and things like that?
I'll give you my take, and then these guys can jump in. The dissecting fun part partly comes from having some background in playing games. You can't just walk in off the street and don't play with toys or don't play with games and have any clue about what, you know, is sort of going on. You might know what you like, but to sort of dissect it. So there's a little bit of history that goes on with that. But it's a case of trusting people. There are some people who sort of intuitively, you know, I'm not talking about me, these guys. There are some people you intuitively trust. There's a reason, you know, watch this. Okay.
And this team was unbelievable, and it was great all around. I mean, from one end to the other, and the people that aren't here, which says a lot about what we were able to accomplish.
I mean, the only thing I'll add to answer the question, and it's just as an observer, and I think today's games, if you look at pinball over the past 10 years, 20 years since, well, I guess it's been 13 years since Williams ended, I think that the design philosophy, by and large, has become much more subjective, not objective. I don't know if there is dissection to the degree that Pat has expressed. I think that, and again, it's principally Stern. The verdict is still out to see what happens with Wizard of Oz. I think the design philosophy has been, I'll use this term, and I don't mean it negatively, although it's going to sound negatively, how do we screw the player? How do we do things in such a fashion where we want to emphasize the ball being wild, but not in the pristine way that Larry was describing from games in the 60s, where, you know, we don't have house balls anymore. And, you know, when I started playing pinball, you just accepted that. We used to laugh if somebody got a point. He only got a point. That's funny. Now you can't accept that. I mean,
Now we laugh if you're under a billion.
Yeah, really. But I think, and again, without belaboring it, and I know that we're running short on time.
Let me jump in real quick. Larry, I used to walk into Larry's office. Larry would be sitting there programming the games we worked on together. And Larry would bang his coffee cup down and he'd go, "That's not fun." And that's what it amounted to. You know, you'd put something together, you'd put it in a game, and you'd play it, and you'd stand there and play it, and you'd go, "Dude, that sucks. You know, we can't do that. That's no good. That's not good enough for us."
And to follow on that, you know, it's you have to be able to say "that sucks," and you have to be able to hear "that sucks" and not go crawling off under your desk. You had to check your ego at the door. You had to know it wasn't about you. It was about what you did, and tomorrow you're going to do better.
And you have to unscrew the parts from the playfield where they suck, okay, and take them back out and go, which you've all heard my story in the past about what happened at the end of Funhouse when I had to tear a target out of there because Mark Ritchie came back after lunch one day and said, that sucks. Okay, you've got to be smart enough and you've got to be a big boy enough to look at what you're doing and go, I worked, in the case of the software guys, okay, they could have just spent 3 days putting a set of rules in a game and they go, oh, no.
And thankfully, when you change software, it doesn't leave a pile of eraser stuff next to your desk.
Or sawdust on the floor.
But again, I guess the big thing is that, yes, philosophically, things have changed. I mean, I view it, and I think that it's a shame that we've gotten to the level, not just geometrically, but also with rule sets of games where you just don't know what you're doing, why you're doing it, when you should be doing it. You may want to play it a different way, but they're forcing you to play it in this particular fashion. And I think that the purity and the spontaneity of playing a pinball machine for the first time, going up to it, that's changed. When you get involved more and more in being exposed to a new game and playing it more, I think it becomes really apparent to any player at any skill level, do I like this or don't I like this? And it's not even a question anymore of watching tournament play and seeing people dissect a game and only going for a particular area, and the programming goes to the point of trying to force those people to play differently.
So. But by the way, what I just said goes for every single person that's sitting in front of you. In every one of their disciplines, whether it was John with mechanical engineering or John with his art or Larry or Chris, okay, everybody up there in their own discipline was willing to say, what I just did wasn't good enough. I have to redo it. I have to make it better. We've got time for one more question. One more question. There you go.
Okay, I hope it's not rude, and I don't have any direct answers, but I hear stories of, like, game productions, like numbers like how, like, high, like Steve Ritchie's Flash made a lot. High Speed made a lot of games. The whole royalty thing and the pay scale, I'm just curious, like, because the number of games are jumping really high, and I'm sure you guys have your contracts and your pay scale and royalties per unit, a certain dollar amount of current stores here and there. I just want to know, like, if you can pinpoint a time where maybe, like, you got paid, or, you know, if you can refer to some of the numbers where you went home and your wife just goes, we had that feeling like this is going to work for us, you know, we're making it, you know, where the industry just, I don't know, like in the movies, like the toy industry was like a $1 billion industry made more than the movie that you guys reached the pinnacle of your career or the point where you go, this is going to work for us.
What's the question?
I guess what I want to know is, what game did you leave the office and have that feeling just going home to your family like, I'm really able to take care of my family now, you know, and that financially, like this game's...
2 seconds after we walked into Williams. That's the answer. I've said this before in front of all of you. The luckiest day of my life was the day that Larry DeMar found me. The second luckiest day of my life was when I walked into Williams and they said, here's a drawing board. And at that point, it's up to you to either show somebody you can do what you can do or you can't, because they were going to give you the tools it took to do what you wanted to do. Okay, and it was up to you to either prove you could do it or sink. And there were people who sunk and there were people who proved they could do it. And in a lot of respects, it was a brutal atmosphere in that place. You showed up every day and you better prove how good you were. But you know what? It was a hell of a lot of fun. It was a hell of a lot of fun.
On my first day at Williams, I was going to work with Mark Ritchie. That was my first project. But I met Steve. And Steve was just, you know, High Speed was on the line when I got there. And Steve walked up to me. We had a brief conversation. And he paid me a very nice compliment. To be honest, I don't remember what it was. But, I turned to him and I said, wow, that's really nice. How come you're being so nice to me? And he said, because we have such high expectations of you. And that, I mean, you know, I was tremendously lucky to walk in having done something that nobody there had ever done before. done, I got a master's degree in computer music from a great university, and I had a goofy reel that had beeps and boops on it that I'd made on purpose, not for money. And they said, wow, you could do that for us and we'd pay you. You know, so that was pretty...
Okay, we got to go. There's some people who are waiting to bend your ear with their seminar. So we really appreciate your time. Thank you all for coming.